This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 27, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Syria, deadly attacks on civilians from security forces continue as new sanctions from the EU go into effect and a break-off opposition group endorses armed resistance. Documents made public by WikiLeaks reveal a Texas-based company's shadow dealings with the military and government clients and how it monitored activists for years. And we'll go to India, where hundreds of workers in the country's quartz factories are fighting for justice after working in dangerous conditions. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Violence sparked by U.S. troops who burned the Quran continues in Afghanistan. 9 people died today when a suicide bomber detonated at the gates of an airport and NATO base in Jalalabad. Dozens have died in the last 6 days. The United Nations moved all staff out of its office in Kunduz after an attack Saturday. They say they will continue to provide services in the region. And NATO, France, the U.S., and the U.K. have all recalled their staff from Afghan ministries, citing security concerns. The U.S. has extended apologies for the desecration of the Quran, calling it an accident. In Yemen today, outgoing President Ali Abdullah Saleh formally handed over power to Abrabu Mansour Hadi. Hadi was elected by a landslide. He was the only candidate on the ballot. The country's prime minister stayed away from the ceremony in protest. Other protesters took to the streets outside. Deposed President Saleh returned to the country for the event. It's unclear where he will settle. Hadi will serve a transitional term of 2 years when new elections will be held. Several hundred people, Latino, African American, and white, marched down Main Street in East Haven, Connecticut Saturday, calling for the mayor to resign in the wake of a racial profiling scandal. Melinda Tuhus reports from East Haven.
The people united will never be defeated.
Marchers carried signs against racial profiling and huge banners made of many nations' flags. Last month, East Haven's longtime police chief retired after being named an unindicted co-conspirator in the racial profiling case in which 4 officers were arrested. During the years-long Justice Department probe, former chief Leonard Gallo was placed on leave. When Mayor Joe Maturo took office, he reinstated Gallo and staunchly defended the chief. In recent weeks, Maturo's been widely criticized for making derogatory remarks about Latinos. Herman Zuniga led the new group of East Haven immigrants who organized the march. He said cooperation was excellent with the interim police chief, who came from outside the department.
The police department is changing, but we need more changes than that.
Some East Haveners along the route were supportive, while others said they wished the immigrants would just go away. After the march, Mayor Maturo released a statement praising all involved and pledging to rebuild trust with all segments of the community. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, East Haven.
In a military court in Hawaii last Friday, a jury found Lance Corporal Carlos Orozco III not guilty of all charges related to the suicide in Afghanistan of Lance Corporal Henry Liu. Orozco was charged for allegedly hazing Liu before his death. He was the last of 3 soldiers charged. The first settled for 30 days and a 1-rank demotion. The second was also fully acquitted. The Indian government lodged a formal complaint today with the International Olympic Committee demanding they cancel a sponsorship deal with Dow Chemical. Bismillah Gilani reports.
The complaint follows last week's announcement by the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, that they would not drop Dow Chemicals as one of the main sponsors of the 2012 London Olympics. The sports minister said the IOC's decision goes against the very ideals of the Olympic movement. Dow is the current owner of the Union Carbide Corporation, the firm responsible for Bhopal gas disaster, which caused the deaths of as many as 20,000 people. In New Delhi today, hundreds of victims of Bhopal disaster held a demonstration urging the government to boycott the summer games. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Changes to Google's privacy policies will take effect this week. Beginning Thursday, Google will share information about who you are and where you go on the internet with other Google services. Last Friday, a federal judge dropped a lawsuit brought by the Electronic Privacy Information Center that sought to force the FTC to block the Google changes. Judge Amy Berman Jackson did not address the merits of the privacy changes. She only said that it wasn't up to the court to force the FTC to take action. FTC Chair John Leibowitz said Sunday that if a given company is explicit about how they use data, then consumers can make informed choices and market competition over privacy policies may emerge. But he would not say much about the specific Google privacy changes.
Other than saying that they have been clear and that it's a fairly binary and somewhat brutal choice that they're giving consumers, I think I can't say much more, and I'll just leave it at that. But we're aware.
Last year, the Federal Trade Commission and Google reached a settlement on privacy after the internet giant tried to force users onto Google Buzz and publicized private information. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. In Syria, military attacks continued in cities throughout the country today as residents and activist groups reported heavy shelling of civilian centers and raids and arrests by government forces. At least 185 people have been killed since Saturday, according to the local coordination committees, a coalition of activist groups. The group also revised the total death toll to more than 8,000, including more than 5,800 civilians, since pro-democracy protests began under the regime of Bashar al-Assad nearly a year ago. The Red Cross delivered food and other goods to the central city of Hama today. According to the aid group, it was the first time staff reached residents since mid-January. Also today, the European Union imposed new sanctions against Syria's regime, including freezing the assets of the country's central bank. The increasing pressure and ongoing violence takes place as the Assad regime announced the approval of a constitutional referendum today. Assad and Syria's ally, Russia, pointed to the referendum as a sign of reform. But media reports showed light turnout at polls on Sunday, and activists criticized the legitimacy of a vote during ongoing attacks and violence. For more, we go to Hivin Kako, spokesperson for the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. She joins us from Oxford, England. Thanks for speaking with us.
Hi, welcome.
Today marks more than 3 weeks since the military stepped up shelling of neighborhoods of homes. What updates have you heard from residents there?
Well, unfortunately, we have such a bad news. We have confirmed it very recently. I mean, the first thing is, like, so far today, we had 12 people have been killed in the bombardment of different neighborhoods and homes, including 11 in Bab al-Amr. But the shocking news that we just confirmed half an hour ago that 68 dead body has arrived to the National Hospital in the city of Homs.
And these 68 bodies that, as you say, you've just confirmed taken to the hospital within the last hour, what more do you know about how they were killed and the circumstances around their deaths?
We have no more information so far. We're still working to find out more information. But so far is that these people, they were running away, leaving the city of Homs, and they were killed, and their body have reached to the hospital in the last hour. So it's quite 68 bodies, and we're still checking if more bodies will arrive later. We're calling for an investigation, and we're calling that some members of a respectable organization, including some lawyers from our organization, to join in this investigation.
Well, this has been a concern with the situation in Homs. Aid groups have called it a humanitarian crisis. Is there any sign that there is access to residents of Homs to get medical supplies or food and basic supplies to residents there?
Well, so far still, the Red Cross cannot get access to the city. It's not working. The humanitarian situation in general is miserable all across Homs. They need an urgent help, and we still calling for the international community to force the Syrian regime to accept to get help to the city, to help these people, to have to get medical attention. It's still, the situation is unchanged. It's very miserable.
The BBC is reporting a fresh offensive against northern towns, reporting that troops have been firing artillery, mortars, and anti-aircraft guns near Idlib. What about the northern area or other parts that have seen violence today?
Well, so far today, four people were killed in the rural area of Aleppo City and in the city of Anadan. And there have been clashes there, and in Idlib as well, where nine people were killed. One of them were killed under torture. The rest were killed in the clashes today. And in the clashes between the regular army and army defector, six members of the army and security forces were killed at the city of Anadan in Aleppo, that's the north of Syria. And there were clashes, and yes, there is news of a helicopter as well falling down, and six members of the regular army being killed in the north of Syria in the city of Aleppo.
There was also news today about the opposition movement, and a wing of the opposition Syrian National Council broke off and formed a different group that does support armed resistance to the government. This comes from the international conference in Tunis last week that did not recognize a single group as representative of the opposition movement. And the U.S. has been reluctant to endorse any one group. What's the effect on mounting a strong opposition to Assad's regime, having the opposition divided as it is?
Well, I mean, we blame this fragmented opposition to be part of prolonging the suffering of the Syrian people. I mean, we hope that they will unify and be strong enough so that the international community can give them support and things can get moving forward, because we need the international community and the world to support the Syrian people and the opposition to have a solution similar to the Yemeni scenario, where they pressurize al-Assad to step down and agree for a transitional period for somebody to step in and get Syria towards democracy, democracy slowly.
Hiven Kako is a spokesperson for the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. She joined us from England for an update on the situation in Syria. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
More than 5 million emails from the private intelligence corporation Stratfor will be released to the public in the latest document dump from WikiLeaks. The leaked emails span from 2004 to 2011 and paint a picture of a new breed of corporation, one which relies on inside informants and paid sources and sells the information it gathers to its military, government, and corporate clients. Some of the communications from the Texas-based company, which WikiLeaks calls a private spy and a shadow CIA, reveal its role in monitoring activists from Canada to India. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
WikiLeaks began publishing what they're calling the Global Intelligence, or GI, files early Monday morning. The data comes from more than 5 million emails from the corporation Stratfor, which does intelligence gathering and analysis for powerful private and government groups, ranging from Dow Chemical to the U.S. Marine Corps. The international hacker collective Anonymous has taken credit for obtaining the documents, and more than 25 media organizations around the world are partnering with WikiLeaks to distribute them. At a press conference in London on Monday, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange explained what the emails reveal about Stratfor and similar corporations.
Over the last 10 years, the private intelligence industry has boomed in the United States and in other countries. But with its growth, there has not been a commensurate growth in accountability mechanisms that should be investigating and controlling these organizations, like the controls that are placed on government intelligence organizations and military intelligence organizations.
Assange pointed to specific emails that highlight the revolving door between government and private sector intelligence work, Stratford's use of bribes and insider sources, and the group's advice on international money laundering. Assange also drew attention to emails revealing that corporations pay Stratfor to monitor activist groups, including People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA.
Stratfor was hired by the Coca-Cola Corporation to We monitor and assess PETA activists in relation to the 2009 Vancouver Olympics. The questions from Coca-Cola were, what is the number of PETA supporters in Canada? How many of these are inclined towards activism? The links between PETA in Canada and PETA in the US or elsewhere? PETA's methodology for planning and executing activism, and the risk of non-PETA hangers-on.
In one of the leaked emails, Stratfor Vice President Fred Burton offered to share the FBI's classified file on PETA. Burton used to head the Diplomatic Security Service at the U.S. State Department. PETA released a statement Monday saying they can't imagine Coke drinkers will celebrate the company secretly conspiring to stop PETA protests about the killing of baby seals. They also said the revelation contradicts Coca-Cola's people-friendly image. Other leaked documents reveal that Dow Chemical paid Stratfor to monitor activists in India who continue to protest the 1984 Union Carbide plant disaster in Bhopal, as well as the international groups who support them.
One assumes that one is being monitored when one is doing things that threaten large corporations or trying to threaten them.
That's Andy Bickelbaum, a member of the satirist activist group The Yes Men. On the 20th anniversary of the Bhopal disaster, he successfully posed as a Dow Chemical executive in a live television interview.
So I went on BBC December 4th, 2004, and announced to the world that we, Dow Chemical, were taking full responsibility for the Bhopal catastrophe and compensating the survivors, as well as cleaning up the site, etc., etc., etc.
Since that prank, the Yes Men have remained involved in drawing attention to the survivors of the massive gas leak, which killed thousands and continues to harm the health and environment of Bhopal today. The leaked Stratfor email chain titled Yes Men Monitoring shows that the company collected and analyzed all the press releases, media mentions, and Twitter posts from the Yes Men. In their periodic reports to Dow Chemical, they focused most on the group's efforts to use Bhopal to spark a larger discussion on corporate impunity.
That is what they are freaking out about. They were really concerned about us taking this limited issue, Bhopal, and spinning it into a really big global systemic issue about corporations and the overall picture in which they can just do whatever they want.
Stratfor released a statement Monday calling the email hack deplorable and illegal, and refusing to validate any of the published information. The statement also says, quote, like all private emails, they were written casually, with no expectation anyone other than the sender and the recipient would ever see them. They should be read as such. Some of the more casual emails refer to members of Hezbollah as Hezis, and call the Subversive Alliance for the Liberation of the Earth, Animals, and Humans Mexico Hippie Bombers. Thousands more hacked emails will be released in the coming days. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Israel, hunger strikes continue by Palestinian prisoners being held without charge. One of those is Hannah Ashalabi, who today entered her 12th day of an open-ended hunger strike. 2 weeks ago, Israeli officials ordered Ashalabi to be put under administrative detention for 6 months. Yesterday, they moved her to solitary confinement. FSRN's Ghassan Banora has the story.
Hannah Ashalabi was imprisoned for 2 years without charge before being released as part of the last October's prisoner swap deal with Israel. Now she's imprisoned again. Her brother, Ammar Ashalabi, explained to FSRN how the army arrested his sister 2 weeks ago.
When the army came to our house, at first they said they are not going to arrest her. 5 minutes later, they started to intimidate us and became violent. After that, they assaulted my sister along with my older brother before arresting her. That's what happened.
Protesting the legality of administrative detention, Hannah Ashalabi is one of many prisoners who've resorted to hunger strikes. Another detainee, Adnan Khadr, reached a near-death condition and organ failure after 2 months of a hunger strike. He ended his strike last week when Israel pledged to release him in April. Israel uses administrative detention to hold Palestinians without charge. Some people are held for years, and experts say it's difficult to get people out. Ayman Karaja is a researcher for Al-Damir Association for Human Rights.
Basically, administrative detention orders deprive the defendant and the lawyers the right to refute the charges because there are no charges presented by the military prosecutor. The file is usually inaccessible by the lawyers under the pretext of being classified. The court justifies the secrecy of the files as a high security need of the occupying state.
Palestinian human rights groups estimate that Israel is currently detaining 4,500 Palestinian prisoners, 300 of them administrative detention. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
In Gujarat, India, hundreds of workers are struggling with severe health problems due to unsafe conditions in quartz factories. Many have acquired the life-threatening disease silicosis, which is caused by exposure to silica dust released during the mining of slate, sandstone, and quartz. With inadequate anti-pollution systems in place, workers continue to get sick, and many are still waiting for compensation in order to get treatment. FSRN's Shuria Niazi has more.
Inside the ramshackle hut, 20-year-old Kailash lies on an old bed. The factory worker from Undle village in Madhya Pradesh looks as frail as an old man. He can neither eat well nor perform his daily chores properly. Kailash had gone to Gujarat to work in a quartz factory 4 years back, but now it is difficult for him to even speak.
I went to Balasanur. Used to crush stone. I used to earn around US $1. It pains.
Similar is the story of 22-year-old Buddha. He has grown so weak that his eyes appear sunken. He cannot pick up heavy objects and any movement is painful. He also frequently suffers from shortness of breath.
Doctors thought we were suffering from TB and treated us accordingly. But it was a different disease. All our savings have been spent in treatment. This disease has ruined us.
In 2005, the three districts of Alirajpur, Jhabua and Dhar in Madhya Pradesh were hit by a severe drought. There was no means of sustenance at the local level. The resulting unemployment forced many people to migrate to Gujarat in search of work. There, many found temporary jobs in quartz crushing factories. The factories extract silica, which is used for manufacturing glass, cosmetics, cast iron and ceramics, among other things. But conditions in the factories aren't safe. The protective masks given to workers are made of thin synthetic material, which doesn't prevent silica dust from entering into their lungs. Inder Singh is a local from Alirajpur district.
One of us went to the Balasinor factory to have a look. He returned and took 5 to 6 along with him. They started working in the factory. He took with him more and more people. As many as 40 to 50 would go together at times. The neighboring village people would follow. Then further more people would go from other adjacent villages.
Silicosis in India is covered under the Employees State Insurance Act and the Workmen's Compensation Act. But affected workers rarely receive compensation because most of them work as unskilled laborers and do not hold a job card, which would entitle them to state insurance benefits. Many of them are not even aware of the legal provisions that protect them. The National Human Rights Commission passed an order in 2010 directing the Madhya Pradesh and Gujarat governments to provide compensation to the people who have been affected by silicosis and ensure their rehabilitation. But workers are still waiting for payment, many of them growing sicker by the day. Amulya Nidhi is in charge of Shilpi Kendra, an NGO that first documented silicosis deaths in the area.
Madhya Pradesh government has promised some initiatives for rehabilitation of the families affected with silicosis, but nothing has been done so far. We are expecting that the Gujarat government must give compensation to these people.
The organization wants the government to conduct a comprehensive review to determine how many people have silicosis. Additionally, workers' advocates want the government to take action against factory owners who employ migrant workers in a dangerous factory environment. Shura Niazi, FSRN, India.
Across the country, Occupy movements are continuing diverse campaigns and actions. Events are taking place today in dozens of cities under the theme, Occupy Our Food Supply. Organizers said events are planned in Brazil, Hungary, Ireland, Argentina, and dozens of U.S. states. Some of the actions include reclaiming unused bank-owned lots to create community gardens, protesting food corporations Monsanto and Cargill, and conducting seed exchanges outside stock exchanges. In Washington, D.C., Occupy protesters are drawing attention to predatory banks and foreclosures by highlighting the case of Bertina Jones, a resident who faces foreclosure from a loan sold from Bank of America to Freddie Mac. In Florida, Occupy Orlando took advantage of the national attention on the NBA All-Star Game. Activists held a celebration they called All Share Weekend to shine a light on income inequality. Sean Canan from WMNF Community Radio reports.
When teachers' rights are under attack, what do we do?
Occupy Orlando billed the All Share Weekend as a time for community, food, entertainment, art, and education, all without the huge price tag of the All-Star Game. Nearly 40 people held signs and banners and chanted as they marched around downtown's Lake Eola Park. Activist Kat Dewar said one goal of the march was to raise awareness about the thousands of Florida residents who are homeless.
You have ordinances in place that make it illegal to take care of these people, to assist your brothers and sisters. So we're wanting to open some dialogue and bring attention to these things today.
A Florida state senator is championing a bill to enforce a Florida law that required sports stadiums to also act as homeless shelters. It unanimously passed a Senate committee in January, but faces dim prospects of getting much further. Occupy Orlando member Diego Atuesta supports that effort and says it's necessary. He illustrated why by telling a story about a woman they tried unsuccessfully to find a spot in a homeless shelter.
Every single shelter in Orlando up to like Daytona was completely full. There was nowhere for her to stay. So like by this happening, like it would open up space for so many people that are just out on the streets sleeping cold like at night, and it's not being used anyway. It's not costing them any money. Like, why can't they just open it and let people sleep there?
Another participant was Doug Head, a community activist and the former chair of the Democratic Party in Orange County, where Orlando is located. Referring to the family of Rich DeVos, who owns the Orlando Magic, he said there's growing frustration with the current economic system only working for the few at the top.
The Occupy challenge to America is, are we going to continue to run the country for the benefit of the DeVos family and basketball team owners and the 1%, or are we going to really be able to arrange the systems, the political systems in this country, to benefit all of us?
Activists hoped that they could shed some light on this inequality while crowds increased for the NBA game. Kat Dewar said, now that the elite players and traveling sports fans have left town, Florida residents should look at what needs to be done in the community.
After the All-Star Weekend has come and gone, my biggest suggestion would be to continue to go out and engage people. Don't walk past someone you see who doesn't have anything. Don't say, I'm not going to give that person money. At least give them water, give them food. Give them a smile and some conversation. Let's start addressing the fact that we are all human beings.
In addition to the Civil Rights March, during All Share Weekend, Occupy Orlando also held what they called a really free market, a swap meet where no money exchanged hands, and they shared food in a community-provided dinner. Sean Canan, Free Speech Radio News, Orlando.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.